Back at it, wrapping up a busy week on Friday, October 23rd, right here on Connecticut Today. In the 3 o'clock hour, we talk with a gentleman who covers the Catholic Church for EWTN regarding recent statements made by the Pope concerning civil unions, possibly, in the Catholic Church. And in the 5 o'clock hour, we talk with an area college professor on the latest presidential debate and communicating during this presidential campaign. Said some things about civil unions, same-sex unions, that you just didn't hear from a previous pope or in the Catholic Church. And to talk about that, we welcome J.D. Flynn. He is editor-in-chief of the Catholic News Agency, part of the EWTN network. J.D., hey, it's Paul here in Bridgeport. How are you, sir?
Hey, Paul. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Well, what exactly did the Pope say a few days ago? Because, you know, I read it and went, gee, that's kind of interesting. And in what form did he make these comments?
Well, Paul, a documentary came out on Wednesday. It had a sort of limited premiere on Wednesday at the Rome Film Festival. The documentary is called Francesco, and it kind of looks at the life and ministry of Pope Francis. It was made by a Russian-born documentarian who's made some big documentaries in the past and been nominated for a couple of Oscars and those kinds of things. In the context of the documentary, there is an interview in which the Pope is talking about pastoral care for LGBT people and the church's sort of disposition of welcome and the importance of that. And in that context, there is a scene in which the Pope says, what we have to create is a civil union law. That way they, and he's referring to people who are gay, that way they are legally covered. And he says, I stood up for that. Now, that is that has made headlines in the church and around the world because it is a shift in the way that the church has talked about civil unions all around the world. And that's obviously not an issue that is as relevant here in the U.S. after the Obergefell decision, where there's gay marriage in the U.S. But in many parts of the world, the sort of marriage debate is ongoing. And so it really reverberated in places where there's still a question about the definition of marriage and civil unions and things like this.
It's interesting that Francis, J.D., and correct me if I'm wrong here, but I guess the first mention of that was in that documentary. Has he alluded to this before, or did he figure, well, hey, let me let it loose now because, you know, this is a film about me and you know, we'll initialize the discussion this way. Do you think that was strategic on his part?
Well, Paul, here's where things get really, really interesting, and here's why this is still kind of a developing story. Back in 2010, when Pope Francis was the Archbishop of Buenos Aires, Argentina, there was a gay marriage debate in the country, a gay marriage referendum, and it's been widely reported that Pope Francis kind of suggested to the other bishops in Argentina that they consider sort of proposing civil unions as a compromise measure. In other words, that they had opposition to gay marriage and to adoption of children by same-sex couples, and so he suggested that they propose a civil union measure that would allow for things like inheritance and hospital visitations and things like that as a kind of compromise. That suggestion didn't fly; it didn't happen. But it's been widely reported over the years that was the approach of Pope Francis to the issue. In 2004, he was asked about civil unions during a debate in Italy. Or 2014, he was asked about civil unions during a debate in Italy about it. And he made some comments that were sort of neither positive nor negative, but distinguished in his mind civil unions from gay marriage, which he opposes. So there have been kind of penumbras of this, but there has not been a clear attestation of that, of the Pope calling for a civil union law until now. But here's what kind of makes it all the more interesting. It's since come out, since the documentary came out, that several pieces of the documentary were really, really heavily edited, that the filmmaker was splicing together individual sentences to make paragraphs from old interviews in ways that seemed to obscure the meaning of what the Pope was saying on a couple of other issues. And so we don't have the original footage of what the Pope said here, and we don't yet know exactly when that'll come out or how it'll shake out. Reporters have been asking the Vatican for clarity on some of this, and we've not yet gotten clarity. So it's not kind of a closed book or a done deal yet, because there are still a lot of questions about the context of that interview.
Wow. So, I mean, J.D., is there a chance here, to use a journalistic phrase that you and I, you know, always use and people in our business, is there a chance that the pontiff got sandbagged here? I mean, is his message consistent, or is the Vatican saying, hey, wait a minute, this is not really what he meant? Wow.
Well, the Vatican isn't saying anything. So people have asked that, right? Because we know that this interview is an excerpt from a larger interview that the Pope did about a year ago, and people have asked, you know, what were the words kind of around this? Now that we've seen some really heavy manipulation of footage in other places in the video, but for more than 48 hours now, the Vatican hasn't said anything. So in a certain way, you know, it's fair to say, I think the Vatican's press offices has at least implicitly sort of owned the Pope's statement by not offering any clarity after question after question. Now, whether that's because they're kind of regrouping and trying to figure out the best way to respond to this crisis or not, I guess we'll find out. They're not. The Vatican does not operate on a 24-hour news cycle, so it's frustrating but not unusual to wait a couple of days before getting clarity, even on something this important and this with this much international attention.
Wow, J.D. Flynn. J.D., hang on. I want to do a couple more quick ones with you. J.D. Flynn, Editor-in-Chief of Catholic News Agency, part of EWTN. J.D., back to you momentarily. First, traffic and weather together at 3:36 on WICC. J.D. Flynn, for a few more minutes. He is Editor-in-Chief of the Catholic News Agency, part of EWTN. We're talking about a statement the Pope made that, I just found out was maybe from some earlier footage, from some earlier interviews, kind of a story that flew under the radar a bit, but did raise some eyebrows regarding civil unions in the church. And J.D., I want to go back to something you said. So from what you understand and what from folks, people that cover the church understand, so the Pope is still not endorsing officially any idea of gay marriage, per se? Is that what you said?
Right. And that won't happen because that's a doctrinal matter that the church teaches can't change. So the church says that it's from the perspective of Catholic doctrine revealed by God that marriage is a relationship between one man and one woman. So even with this discussion of civil unions, which is about how to make sure that same-sex people aren't the subject of unjust discrimination, the idea of same-sex marriage is something that is of a different order of things for the Catholic Church.
Before we get to some of the polling I know you folks are doing as we lead up to the election, a week from this coming Tuesday, the Pontiff also recently, not shying away from controversy, talking about, I believe it was an encyclical that he released, about a couple, 3 weeks ago, regarding what he sees in what he calls a post-COVID world. What's the reaction been to that?
Well, the encyclical, it's called Fratelli Tutti, which it means all of my brothers or all brethren. The encyclical really calls for, in a certain way, what the Pope has called a restoration of the politics of friendship. So a restoration of a view of the world that sees politics and economics as an opportunity to expand justice, expand the protection of human rights, expand economic security and food security around the world, really calling for a revision of sort of economic principles from the idea and social principles from the idea of holding on to what's mine to an idea that thinks about how generous individuals can be, how generous nations can be, how generous families can be. And so calling for that sort of transformation of the political paradigm.
All right, now let's get to some of the polling. I've had some folks on from your organization before, J.D., but the polling you folks are doing, I know, in concert with Real Clear Politics, showing that, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but is the Catholic vote leading up to the election a week from this Tuesday, is it still, give or take a few points, is it still split down the middle here in this current race or not?
No, and in terms of the horse race between the president and Joe Biden, mm-hmm. there is a widening number of Catholics who say that they support Joe Biden. So Biden, among all Catholics, Biden leads the president by 12 points, according to our last poll. Now that gap narrows among people who say they go to mass every week. It comes down to about a 6-point gap at that point, and it also narrows significantly in a number of swing states. So I think it's about 4 points that Biden has a lead in Arizona, Florida, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. So in the swing states, the Biden lead is much tighter than it is more broadly and actually within the poll's margin of error. But in the big picture, that's about a 12-point spread.
Is there a reason, are there sub-questions asked here, J.D., regarding why people are supporting Mr. Trump or Joe Biden or not supporting either one?
Sure. And remember, I think it's helpful to remember that when we talk about Catholic voters, we're talking about people who self-identify as Catholic. And some of them are people who practice the Catholic faith and some of them who are people who aren't. And you can see a real difference both on the issues and on the candidates between people who practice the faith, you know, say that they go to Mass every week or believe what the church teaches and people who don't. But in the aggregate, it's very interesting. Catholic voters said on the whole that they support the appointment of Judge Barrett, of Judge Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. They support her, are pulling for her nomination. Catholic voters have said similar things to what other likely voters have said, in that the pandemic, the economy are major areas of concern. But they've also said, regardless of sort of who they pick in the horse race, that a candidate who supports religious liberty and opposes or supports abortion they've also said that a candidate who supports religious liberty is more likely to get their vote, and a candidate who opposes abortion is more likely to get their vote, even among those who have said that they're voting for Biden. There's a character issue there. There are people who say that they don't agree with Biden's policies, but prefer his character, his temperament, his disposition. And so there are some interesting sort of drilling down that can be done there.
Interesting. J.D. Flynn, Editor-in-Chief of the Catholic News Agency. Good to have you join us this afternoon. J.D., thank you. We appreciate it. Take care.
Thanks so much, Paul.
Appreciate it. J.D. Flynn, he is Editor-in-Chief of the Catholic News Agency. That's part of EWTN. And there you go, folks, to what turned out to be the final debate of this cycle last night at Belmont University in Nashville. Joining us right now from Southern Connecticut State University, Associate Professor of Political Science, Jennifer Hopper. She teaches a course this semester, by the way, oddly enough, on presidential politics. Professor Hopper, how are you? Thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
I'm well, Paul. Good to talk to you.
And I'm sure, geez, you have absolutely no course material that you can look at.
That's right. It's just a big blank space. Nothing to talk about.
That's right. Your syllabus is empty this semester,
yep,
right? Wow.
That's right, yeah. I could do that, and we could just talk about the news every day. Very little work for me. Yep.
Yeah, why not? What did you think of the, what turned out to be the second and final debate last night, a marked difference from the wrestling match we had on the first one?
Yes, I think in part because the first one was so shocking in its nature and just so different from how these debates normally play out, that yesterday the bar was pretty low for how it had to look to be sort of more of what we're used to seeing in conventional presidential politics. And, there's something to say for that, with the state of the world right now, maybe we needed a fairly normal presidential debate. I thought there was a lot of substance in there. The moderator steered the candidates toward the issues. There's a lot of discussion that clearly represented the differences between the two candidates. And all those things are helpful for those few undecided voters that are still out there.
Yeah, I thought Kristen Welker did a good job, and I have moderated debates in the past, and sometimes it can get a little hairy, but, you know, it's almost like a boxing match, Professor. If you see some illegal shots, you know, you have to jump in and say, no, hey, back off, let's do this the right way. I thought she picked and chose her spots pretty professionally when she did jump in, and to elicit some, you know, probing into something that either gentleman said.
I think that that's right. In a lot of ways, moderating these debates is just a thankless task, and we definitely should give credit where credit is due, that she kept them on test. And I think that you're right, that there were times in the debate when you thought, well, you know, she's kind of letting them get a little bit too far away from this, but then she would rein them back in so that she wasn't making her presence sort of overly known in the debate. And I think that's also something that a good moderator tries to do, is to not be the center of attention, but still to keep the two candidates on task and talking about the issues that she was addressing them with.
You know, I know you specialize in presidential communication and politics and communications with your students there at Southern. Let me give you a figure that just popped into my email, Professor. Joe Biden's campaign has set a record. They have spent more money on TV than any other previous campaign. As of us speaking today, they have spent $582 million on television. That is it's a half a billion dollars. That's amazing.
Yeah, the numbers are really jaw-dropping. You know, what we tend to see in terms of campaign finance is every electoral cycle, You see that number go up about just how expensive that these campaigns have become. And Biden has been doing incredibly well in terms of fundraising. And the Trump campaign is now more of in a cash crunch, and they have to pick and choose where they're spending their money, whereas the Biden campaign has a much more free hand to spend willingly.
How do you think the Biden campaign and the Trump campaigns have handled this from a communication standpoint? I mean, Professor, you and I know the base is always there. I've worked on campaigns where, you know, our campaign directors have said, okay, here are the votes we're going to get. Don't worry about them. It's the votes that we have to kind of draw into our camp. How do you think the communication has been amidst both camps to do that?
Yeah, I think it's such an important point about reaching out to swing voters and base versus base voters. And I think that's been one of the challenges for the president in this particular campaign. And I think just generally in terms of his rhetorical style and his outlook on politics and on the world, I think it's just been very difficult for him to speak in a way that doesn't appear to be aimed at his base. I do think he's sought in his communications to attack Biden in a multifaceted way, kind of throwing like a laundry list of attacks at the former vice president. I was listening to your broadcaster, the clip of him talking about Sleepy Joe is one, calling Biden corrupt. And we saw a bunch of that in the debate last night, at one point saying that he was too liberal on some issues, too liberal on law and order issues, on healthcare, but then other times saying he's not liberal enough on criminal justice issues. And I think that that's been a real challenge because none of those attacks have really stuck well to Biden. And Trump just hasn't been as effective at framing Biden the way that he was effective at framing Hillary Clinton back in 2016. So I just don't know that the Trump campaign has really been able to kind of pivot to be able to label Biden in a way that's going to be damaging for Biden as we come up on Election Day here. For the Biden campaign, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, Bob. Go ahead, finish up. Go ahead, please, go ahead.
Yeah. I think for the Biden campaign, you know, it's there have been some kind of remarks made about how he hasn't been a hugely visible presence throughout kind of the pandemic and the summer. And it's because communications wise, he can be prone to gaffes. You know, he can be prone to misspeaking. He is ahead in national polls, in many key swing state polls. And so it's sort of a do no harm kind of strategy. And so they've been effective at that without making it appear as though he's completely dodging tough questions or completely dodging, the answers that the public wants from an individual that they're considering making the president of the United States. At the same time, because Biden has been around for so long, he's also amassed a pretty substantial record. And that is something that the president, I think, has been effective at taking him to task for. In addition, that was something that he brought up last night, that why in your 47 years of politics have you not addressed X, Y, and Z? And Biden was not very effective at responding to that, kind of talked about having a Congress of the opposition party maybe inhibiting some of their ability to get things done during the Obama administration. But that I think, is a weaker point for the Biden campaign communications wise.
And, Professor, it's tough for the president. I've seen these surveys, maybe you have too, that no matter how big the survey is, whether it's Gallup or Quinnipiac or Reuters or Ipsos or HarrisX, all the surveys seem to have this line that when you look at the subtabs here, the crosstabs, as they say, that at least half to two-thirds of the Biden voters aren't voting for his policies, which he's been kind of nebulous on. They're voting for Joe Biden because they don't like Donald Trump. And if you're in the Trump campaign, I don't know what you do to overcome that.
Yeah, his favorability ratings are much lower than Biden's. And there's a Trump fatigue factor. He's not the new kid on the block when it comes to politics. He's not really able to credibly run as an outsider who's going to shake up the system when he's been in office for 4 years. And I agree, there are limits to how you can reintroduce a sitting president, an incumbent president, to the public.
Final question before we wrap up, and I always ask this of college professors when I have you folks on. What do your students think of this whole thing? I mean, you're knee deep in this. You're knee deep in this like we are. We do this as part of our living. But are their eyes like glazed over? They're rolling back in their heads? Are they like, what's going on here?
Yeah. No, I that often gives me a lot of hope. When things seem particularly dark in the political system, I often look to my students because they're not really sort of cynical or jaded about the political process. They also have relatively short memories when it comes to politics. And so it means that, you know, things that seem completely abnormal to us, right, they may think are sort of the contemporary way of doing things. And maybe it's less shocking to them. I would say that overall, they are, at least my students, locked in to what is happening. Mm. They're paying incredibly close attention. I've been teaching for a while now, and when I think back, you know, a decade ago, if I'm thinking about back to past presidential elections, you know, students were interested, especially close to the election day. But now, you know, students, they're well-versed in the issues. They're paying attention to what candidates are tweeting out, right? They're watching debates. And that I find really heartening because that's so important. Paying attention is such a key piece of having a healthy political system in the United States. So if our young people are doing that, and that's something that, that keeps up past this era too, that's something that I'm going to be really happy to see.
Good heartening news to end up with. Jennifer Hopper, Associate Professor of Political Science and Coordinator of the Graduate Program at Southern Connecticut State University. Professor, thank you. Good luck, and we'll talk down the road. Thank you.
Sounds great. Thanks, Paul.
Thanks, Professor Jennifer Hopper, Southern Connecticut State University.